good things are good. That was my first experience of the microclimate of virtue that surrounds Hillary Rodham Clinton, the mystic bond between high-achieving American professionals and the planet's most victimized people, I would discover, is a recurring theme in her life and work. But it's not her theme alone. Regardless of who leads it, the professional class liberalism I have been describing in this recording seemed to be forever traveling on a quest for some place of greater righteousness. It is always engaged in a search for some subject of overwhelming, non-controversial goodness with which it can identify itself and under whose umbrella of virtue it can put across its self-interested class program. There have been many other virtue objects over the years, people and ideas whose surplus goodness could be extracted for deployment elsewhere. The great virtue rush of the 1990s, for example, was focused on children, then thought to be the last word in overwhelming non-controversial goodness. I mean, who could be against kids? No one, of course, and so the race was on to justify whatever your program happened to be in their name. In the course of Hillary Clinton's 1996 book, It Takes a Village, the favorite rationale of the day, think of the children, was deployed to explain her husband's crime bill as well as more directly child-related causes like charter schools. You can find dozens of examples of this kind of liberal class virtue quest if you try, but instead of listing them, let me go straight to the point. This is not politics. It's an imitation of politics. It feels political, yes, it's highly moralistic. It sets up an easy melodrama of good versus bad. It allows you to make all kinds of judgments about people you disagree with, but ultimately it's a diversion. A way of putting across a policy program while avoiding any sincere discussion of the policies in question. The virtue quest is an exciting moral crusade that seems to be extremely important, but at the conclusion of which you discover you've got little to show for it besides NAFTA, bank deregulation, and a prison spree. This book is about Democrats, but of course Republicans do it too. The culture wars unfold in precisely the same way as the liberal virtue quest. They're an exciting ersatz politics that seem to be really important, but at the conclusion of which voters discover they've got little to show for it all besides more free trade agreements, more bank deregulation, and a different prison spree. Champion of the one true Internet. The Clinton Foundation event gives us context in which to understand Hillary's most important moment as a maker of policy, her 4 years as Barack Obama's Secretary of State. Although her purview was foreign policy, we can nevertheless see from her deeds at state how she thinks and the ways she intends to tackle inequality. The themes should be familiar by now: the Internet, innovation, and getting everyone hooked up to the financial industry. In emphasizing these aspects of her tenure at the State Department, I do not mean to brush off the better-known diplomatic triumphs that Hillary Clinton engineered, like the international effort to isolate Iran. Nor do I mean to soft-pedal her better-known diplomatic failures, like the cataclysmic civil war in Libya, a conflict Clinton worked so hard to stoke that the Washington Post in 2011 called it Hillary's War. The concern of this book is ideas, not diplomacy. And the first of the big ideas Hillary Clinton proposed at state was what she called Internet freedom. This was to be the very cornerstone of what was called the 21st Century Statecraft Policy Agenda, according to a State Department press release, and Secretary Clinton returned to the principle frequently. In a high-profile speech in January of 2010, she declared that henceforth the United States stands for a single Internet where all of humanity has equal access to knowledge and ideas. Committing ourselves to defending this unified Internet from all who would censor it, she continued, was a logical extension of what Franklin Roosevelt had been after with his Four Freedoms. It wasn't all that much different from the UN's Universal Declaration of Human Rights either. To Clinton, it was a matter of direct moral simplicity. Open expression on the internet equals freedom. Evil regimes are those that try to suppress that freedom with things like, quote, a new information curtain. Understanding the internet as a force of pure nobility is a revered pundit tradition in the United States. And in the days when Clinton declared humanity's internet freedom, those ideals were on the lips of every commentator. In the summer of 2009, the Iranian regime had violently suppressed a series of enormous street protests. Protests that, the American pundit community immediately determined, had been as much a testament to the power of Twitter as they were about any local grievance having to do with Iran itself. The so-called Twitter revolution fit neatly into the beloved idea that new communications technologies, technologies invented or dominated by Americans, that is, militate by their very nature against dictatorships, a market populist article of faith shared everywhere from Wall Street to Silicon Valley. Then there was the economic side of the single, unified internet, and it, too, was all about liberation. For the people at the bottom of the world's economic ladder, Hillary Clinton averred on that day in 2010, the internet was a savior. She declared that a connection to it was, quote, an on-ramp to modernity. The fear that the internet might create, quote, haves and have-nots was false, she continued. She knew of farmers in Kenya who were using mobile banking technology and of women entrepreneurs somewhere else in Africa who were getting microcredit loans. And she also knew about a doctor who used a search engine to diagnose a disease. I guess she hadn't heard about what was happening to journalists or musicians or taxi drivers in her own country, but I quibble. As long as this technology was free, anyone could see that it pushed in one direction only, and that was up. Clinton spent much of her time as Secretary of State leading the fight for this noble cause. Quote, states, terrorists, and those who would act as their proxies must know that the United States will protect our networks, she said in 2010. At a conference in The Hague in 2011, she took the stage to warn against evil regimes that, quote, want to create national barriers in cyberspace, and to sympathize with business leaders facing tough questions like, quote, is there something you can do to prevent governments from using your products to spy on their own citizens? She was introduced on that occasion by Google's Eric Schmidt, who praised her as, quote, the most significant Secretary of State since Dean Acheson. Hillary reciprocated by calling Schmidt, quote, a co-conspirator, and welcomed the participation of his company, which she said was co-hosting the Freedom Ringing proceedings. As everyone would soon learn with the help of a National Security Agency contractor named Edward Snowden, to understand the internet in terms of this set-piece battle of free speech versus censorship was to miss the point entirely. There's something else the internet makes it easy for governments to do, something called mass surveillance. And as we later learned, the very government Hillary Clinton served was the one doing it. Not some despot in Damascus, not some terrorist in Tripoli, her government. Her government didn't care what you posted in the chat room or whether you talked on your phone all day long. They just wanted to watch and listen as you did. They recorded people's calls. They read people's email. They spied on the president of Mexico. They spied on French business leaders. They listened to the phone calls of some 35 world leaders. They hacked the cell phones of entire nations. They spied on low-level foreign diplomats in order to swindle them at the bargaining table. Hillary Clinton never really had to confront these issues. She stepped down as secretary in February of 2013 while the first news stories about mass surveillance appeared 4 months later. And maybe this is the wrong way to judge her crusade for internet freedom in the first place. Maybe access to the internet was all people needed somewhere on Earth to pull themselves up into prosperity. Take the case of Western intervention in Libya, which her State Department once regarded as something of a triumph. According to a 2011 State Department press release, the Libya intervention showed how we could achieve, quote, post-conflict stabilization using information networks. A leadership team at the ministry formed a plan called eLibya to increase internet access in the country and leverage this information network as a tool to grow new businesses, deliver government services, improve education, and interconnect Libyan society, the release continued. Since the Gaddafi regime denied internet access to more than 90% of Libyans, the potential for positive social, political, and economic change through access to information networks is considerable. The State Department led a delegation of experts to Tripoli to provide concrete expertise in network architecture, law and policy, e-commerce, and e-government for the eLibya plan. It may become a model for digital development through technical knowledge exchange and partnerships across the public and private sectors. And then, Libya sank into civil war, with armed factions, outrageous brutality, and fleeing refugees. Making a stand for internet freedom sounded like a noble goal back in 2011. A cheap way to solve Libya's problems, too. But in retrospect, it was hardly sufficient to quell the more earthly forces that roiled that unhappy land. The Hillary Doctrine. The other great diplomatic initiative during Hillary Clinton's years as Secretary of State was to recast the United States as the world's defender of women and girls. This was the so-called Hillary Doctrine, a virtue quest of the most principled kind. The one superpower was no longer to be an overbearing hegemon or a bringer of global financial crisis. The secretary described the elements of the Hillary Doctrine in 2010 at a TED conference, that great agora of the liberal class. "I have made clear that the rights and the roles of women and girls will be a central tenet of American foreign policy," she said, "because where girls and women flourish, our values are also reflected." "It is," Clinton continued, "in the vital interests of the United States of America to care about women and girls." Here was her reasoning. "Give women equal rights and entire nations are more stable and secure. Deny women equal rights and the instability of nations is almost certain." And here was her conclusion. "The subjugation of women is therefore a threat to the common security of our world and to the national security of our country." I was a little bit alarmed when I heard Secretary Clinton speak these phrases in her deliberate way. Ordinarily, the words vital interest and national security, when combined like this, suggest strong stuff. That the U.S. has a right to freeze assets, organize embargoes, and maybe even launch airstrikes. In this case, I suppose, against countries that score poorly on the gender equality scale. Not to worry. Like so many of the administration's high-minded initiatives, this one turned out to be pretty mundane. The Hillary Doctrine was concerned largely with innovation, with foundations and private companies who would partner with us to do things like improve maternal and child health, close the global gender gap in cellular phone ownership, persuade men and boys to value their sisters and their daughters, and make sure that every girl in the world has a chance to live up to her own dreams and aspirations. Above all, the Hillary Doctrine was about entrepreneurs. It was women in business whose potential Hillary Clinton wished to unleash. It was their dreams and innovations that she longed to see turned into, quote, successful businesses that generate income for themselves and their families. Let us note in passing that although the Hillary Doctrine sounded idealistic, it actually represented no great change in U.S. foreign policy. Its most obvious application was as a justification for our endless wars in the Middle East, which had commenced as a response to the terrorism of 9/11 and were now mutating into a campaign against sexism. Indeed, the principles of the Bush administration themselves sometimes cast their war with radical Islam as a feminist crusade, and the Hillary Doctrine merely picked up where the Bush Doctrine left off. But let's not be too quick to brush the whole thing off as empty propaganda. Among other things, the Hillary Doctrine helps us understand what Hillary really thinks about the all-important issue of income inequality. Women entrepreneurs, as the solution for economic backwardness is not a new idea, after all. It comes directly from the microfinance movement, the poverty-fighting strategy that has been pushed by the World Bank since the 1990s, and Hillary's idea brings with it an entire economic philosophy. For starters, it is closely connected with the World Bank's larger project of structural adjustment, in which countries were required to reform their economies in the familiar market-friendly ways, privatizing, deregulating, and downsizing. And then on the bright side, Western organizations would help those countries' poor people with microloans. It's hard to overstate the attraction of microlending to the liberal class, or at least to that part of it working in the foreign aid sector. Microlending, such people came to believe, was the magic elixir for the disease of poverty, the financial innovation that would save the third world. Foundations embraced it. Thousands of careers were built on it. Billions of dollars were spent advancing it. The United Nations declared 2005 the International Year of Microcredit. Muhammad Yunus, the Bangladeshi economist who popularized microlending, won the Nobel Prize in 2006. 3 years later, Barack Obama gave Yunus the Presidential Medal of Freedom. And it was also simple. While national leaders busied themselves with the macro matters of privatizing and deregulating, microlending would bring the science of markets down to the individual. Merely by providing impoverished individuals with a tiny loan of $50 or $100, it was thought, you could put them on the road to entrepreneurial self-sufficiency. You could make entire countries prosper. You could bring about economic development itself. What was most attractive about microlending was what it was not, what it made unnecessary, any sort of collective action by poor people coming together in governments or unions. The international development community now knew that such institutions had no real role in human prosperity. Instead, we were to understand poverty in the familiar terms of entrepreneurship and individual talent, as though the hard work of millions of single, unconnected people, plus cell phones, bank accounts, and a little capital, were what was required to remedy the third world's vast problems. Millions of people would sell one another baskets they had made, or coal they had dug out of the trash heap, and suddenly they were entrepreneurs, on their way to the top. The key to development was not doing something to limit the grasp of Western banks, in other words. It was extending Western banking methods to encompass every last individual on Earth. Microlending is a perfect expression of Clintonism, bringing together wealthy financial interests with rhetoric that sounds outrageously idealistic. Microlending permits all manner of networking, virtue-seeking, and profit-taking among the lenders while doing nothing to change actual power relations, the ultimate win-win. Bill Clinton's administration made microlending a proud point of emphasis in U.S. foreign policy, and Hillary has been a microlending enthusiast since her first days on the national stage. She promoted it as a form of female empowerment in a famous 1995 speech she made in Beijing, and she supported microlending efforts wherever the first family traveled in the 1990s. There's even an exhibit on the subject at the Clinton Presidential Library that shows Hillary giving a speech in the Gaza Strip in front of a sign that reads, Women's Empowerment Through Microlending. In 1997, she co-hosted a global microcredit summit in Washington, D.C., replete with the usual third world delegations. Hillary's own remarks on that occasion were unremarkable, but those of the president of the Citicorp Foundation were well worth remembering. Here is what he said to the assembled saviors of the third world. Everyone in this room is a banker, because everyone here is banking on self-employment to help alleviate poverty around the world. At the closing session of the summit, bankers joined national leaders singing, We Shall Overcome. In the decade that followed, the theology of microlending developed a number of doctrinal refinements. The idea that women were better borrowers and better entrepreneurs than men. The belief that poor people needed mentorship and, quote, financial inclusion in addition to loans. the suggestion that they had to be hooked up to a bank via the internet, the discovery that it was morally okay to run microlending banks as private, profit-making enterprises, many of the arguments that I had heard at the No Ceilings conference, expressed in the unforgettable tones of international female solidarity. These ideas were the core of the Hillary Doctrine. Hillary's ambassador at large for global women's issues, Milan Verveer, declared in 2011 that, quote, financial inclusion is a top priority for the U.S. government, and announced her terrible chagrin that, quote, 3 billion people in the world remain unbanked. The majority of them are women. Hillary's Undersecretary for Democracy and Global Affairs, Maria Otero, came to state from one of the biggest American microlending institutions. In her official U.S. government capacity, she expressed her joy at how microfinance had evolved, quote, from subsidized microloans to a focus on self-sufficiency, to an emphasis on savings, to a full suite of financial products delivered by commercial regulated banks, and how all this had, quote, affirmed the capacity of the poor to become economic actors in their own right. Hillary herself proudly recalls in her memoirs how the State Department rebuilt Afghanistan by handing out, quote, more than 100,000 small personal loans to the women of that country. These are fine, sterling sentiments, but they suffer from one big problem. Microlending doesn't work. As strategies for ending poverty go, microlending appears to be among the worst that has ever been tried, just one step up from doing nothing to help the poor at all. In a carefully researched 2010 book called Why Doesn't Microfinance Work?, the development consultant Milford Bateman debunks virtually every aspect of the microlending gospel. It doesn't empower women, Bateman writes. It makes them into debtors. It encourages people to take up small, futile enterprises that have no chance of growing or employing others. Sometimes micro-borrowers don't even start businesses at all. They just spend the loan on whatever. Even worse, the expert studies that originally sparked the microlending boom turn out, upon re-examination, to have been badly flawed. Nearly every country where microlending has been an important development strategy for the last few decades, Bateman writes, is now a disaster zone of indebtedness and economic backwardness. When the author tells us that, quote, the increasing dominance of the microfinance model in developing countries is causally associated with their progressive deindustrialization and infantilization, he's being polite. The terrible implication of the facts he has uncovered is that what microlending achieves is the opposite of development. Even communism, with its 5-year plans, worked better than this strategy does, as Bateman shows in a tragic look at microloan-saturated Bosnia. There's a second reason the liberal class loves microfinance, and it's extremely simple. Microlending is profitable. Lending to the poor, as every subprime mortgage originator knows, can be a lucrative business. Mixed with international feminist self-righteousness, it's also a bulletproof business, immune to criticism. The million-dollar paydays it has brought certain microlenders are the wages of virtue. This combination is the real reason the international goodness community believes that empowering poor women by lending to them at usurious interest rates is a fine thing all around.